This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people. Hello and welcome to this episode of the MDT podcast. I am Jo Preston and I'm a consultant geriatrician at St George's in Southwest London.
And I'm Ian Wilkinson, I'm a consultant geriatrician in Redhill. And this week we're going to be talking about the cultural aspects of ageing and the older person.
And with us in the studio we have some people to help.
So I'm Jackie Lelks and I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Brighton in social work.
And I'm Eva Lillis, I am a registrar down in East Surrey.
And also Gagandeep Singh Alg, who is a fellow consultant at St George's, helped us to put this episode together, but unfortunately he's got clinic this afternoon, so couldn't join us.
So coming up this week, we're going to talk about some of the cultural aspects of ageing in relation to ethnicity in particular. We're going to have a think about some conditions and situations in which culture needs to be actively considered as part of a care plan. Hopefully by doing that, you'll feel a bit more confident and being able to anticipate and discuss the cultural considerations with your own patients, and we'll be able to adapt your care plans to those individual people. But first, we're going to have a think about some stuff from social media this week.
Yeah.
Jo, what have you got?
So I've got quite a nice infographic from Helen Bevan about how we learn, which is really lovely. So I'll put a link up to this. So it's got quite a lot of words on it, but it's talking about the kind of cognitive elements of learning. So how we learn, talking about it's all about connections. And then she talks through some myths and some truths. The little intro she has is, so you want to understand the world and or help others understand the world. Sadly, there are a lot of misconceptions about how people learn. Thankfully, cognitive science is showing us what really works. So yeah, I'll put a link to that and you can check it out. I quite like it. It's nice.
And I have a tweet from the British Geriatric Society from their publication Age and Ageing. And this was an article that came out about keeping patients nil by mouth who have swallowing difficulties. So I think we're always very quick to keep people nil by mouth. And that shows that actually it makes no difference to what pathogens they grow in terms of pneumonia. So I think it's for us to sort of think about it a bit more, especially those poor patients who get put nil by mouth on a Friday evening and stay there until they can have a SALT assessment on a Saturday, so, or on a Monday even. So, you know, it's a long time for our patients to be nil by mouth, so that might be more detrimental. And actually, although we're doing it in the for the best for the patient, we think actually it mightn't help at all, or it doesn't help at all.
And it's often a much more complicated decision than it seems.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So my one, I've got an article that James Frith tweeted about, which is from the BMJ Open Journal. And the title of the article is Association Between Gaps in Antihypertensive Medication Adherence and Injurious Falls in Older Community-Dwelling Adults. So what they did was this was an Irish study, and it starts by the fact saying that we know that when people are put on an antihypertensive, that initial time when they first start taking it is the greatest risk for falls. And so the hypothesis is, well, what happens if people stop taking them for a while and then restart them? Does that risk come back? And their conclusion was that each five-day gap in antihypertensives adherence increased the risk of self-reported falls by 18%.
So after they've stopped, or when they go back on it?
When they go back on it, yeah. Well, each gap, it's the gap that increases the risk of falls. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. So I'll put a link to the article and you can go and delve into the methodology and all of that behind that. This week, we're going to cover some key aspects about or sort of scratch the surface of thinking about some of the cultural aspects of ageing and older adults.
And actually, in doing this, we have been thinking about whether we might in the future pull this out to be several episodes in a series together, because this is such a huge area to think about. And so to do culture in sort of half an hour, 40 minutes is stupid, really. But what we're going to do is we're going to start with some introductions, some definitions around what culture is, ways to think about it. And then the second half of the episode is going to be a little bit more about some of the practical elements we might see within healthcare in particular in different cultural groups.
So I think the first bit to think about is what is culture?
Cultural differences, it's increasingly seen as quite an important factor to consider for both health and social care. I think I've said that. But it refers to a group or a community who share common experiences, beliefs, traditions, history, language, and that shapes the way its members see the world and understand the world. And it includes groups we are born into, so our race, our nationality, our gender, class, religion, all of those factors. But it can also include groups that we choose to join. So you're all doctors, so you've joined a group. Or we can have interests that we join, and that's a culture. We form our own culture around that. So it's a strong part of everybody's life. It influences most things about us, including our views and our values and our hopes, our worries, our fears. And it impacts on the way that we see the world and the way that we behave.
So cultural knowledge, what you know is what you know about the characteristics, history, value, beliefs or behaviours of another ethnic or cultural group, not just the one you're in. And to develop cultural awareness, you have to understand yourself and what biases you have, but also to ensure that they don't impact the way you interact with other people from different cultures. And that self-awareness enables a person to become more culturally sensitive. So cultural sensitivity is when you're curious, showing empathy and respect and not making any judgments. So the following questions can help you determine the level of sensitivity. So how accepting are you of people from a different cultural background? What stereotypes and prejudices do you associate with the ethnic group that you identify with? How are your beliefs, values and outlook on life different from people of other backgrounds? What is your attitude towards older people who are difficult to understand because of an accent or difficulty speaking English? And how do you overcome those prejudices?
And when you think about your cultural identity, it's important to think about the fact that everyone has a cultural identity, regardless of whether or not they recognise it or define it in themselves. And sometimes culture is just the way that we do things here. And to a certain extent, in hospitals, we have a number of different cultures. You'll have one bit on one ward, and then you'll have your department type culture, and then you'll have the culture in the canteen and everything. They're all sort of different facets of that. And culture and cultural identity are dynamic, and they're constantly changing as we move in and out of different cultural groups. And people may be influenced by and identify with more than one culture or one cultural group, which makes me think about a talk I was at recently by Julian Stodd, who's an educationalist, talking about workplace culture and drawing on the work of Leven Wenger, who talked about communities of practice and how people learn within specific communities. And I sort of equate some of that to culture, I think. But you should go and check out Julian's. He does little pamphlet books that you can download off his website, which is Sea Salt Learning. .com or something, I think, but it's Sea Salt Learning. If you Google it, it comes up, and they've got really good stuff about workplace culture. Religion can influence cultural beliefs, although often people separate their culture from their religion. And a person's culture can affect their health, as culture may have a bearing on the choices that people make when managing their health. For example, people of Punjabi origin believe that eating Kerala, which is a bitter melon or gourd, will treat their hypertension rather than medications. And that can be a barrier to delivering some of the healthcare that you intuitively think that you want to deliver.
So essentially, this is kind of synonymous with person-centred care, which we've talked about before, and something that I think we all kind of strive to deliver. In this episode, we're going to concentrate predominantly on ethnicity and accepting that there are lots of different ways that we could frame this episode. And as I said, we're likely to do some more episodes on this in future, looking at different cultures, maybe looking at religion and some subcultures as well. But for now, that's what we're going to concentrate this episode on so that we can get through.
So should we go through some examples of cultural aspects of ageing?
So, for example, Native Americans prize the virtue of wisdom, and younger members seek the wisdom of tribal elders to help explore their current problems.
I love that. And I love that there's a science behind that now too, that we know that your memory changes as you get older, and that the memory that links cause and effect gets better as you get older, which is essentially wisdom.
Nice.
I can't remember the proper name for that type of memory, but yeah.
So I might get better.
it might, yeah. Then let's move around the world. Let's go to Vietnam.
So in Vietnam, elders have a strong influence in the family and the decisions that they make. And they regularly looked to by other members of the family to seek advice.
Let's go across the South China Sea.
So in Asian cultures, like in Japan and China, senior members of the family are really treasured. And it's the norm for elders to live with and be cared for by the younger generations.
We'll come south a bit to Korea.
So special festivities honour quite advanced birthdays. So a Hwangap or a 60th birthday is a time when children celebrate their parents' passage into old age and the impact on advances in healthcare in their life expectancy. At 70, there's another celebration known as Ko Kui, I hope I've pronounced that okay, which means old and rare, which is really lovely.
Then let's come a long way south down to Indigenous Australian communities.
So they believe specific foods are only for older members of the community. So, for example, our Aboriginal people believe that wildcat and kangaroo are to be reserved for the elders and will cause physical harm if eaten by younger people.
Whiz up across the...
Just showing off.
The edge of the Pacific and over the Indian Ocean now.
So in Hindi culture, the suffix G is added to names to show deference and respect and demonstrate an appreciation of the older person's place in society.
And finally, in the Philippines, older people are honoured with a symbolic gesture called the Mano Po, in which the younger person takes the hand of the older person and touches the back of the older person's hand to their head as a sign of respect. And different cultures have their own rules about body language and interpretations of hand gestures. So, for example, in some cultures, we'll point with the entire hand to show direction, or to show, you know, pointing to a bit of the body, whereas other people, because pointing with a single finger is sort of culturally very rude, whereas in other cultures, direct eye contact is considered disrespectful, and in other places, not making eye contact would be disrespectful. And there's often two sides to the same sort of gesture.
I think in healthcare, it's really important that we know those things. So I worked for a while in New Zealand, and for the Maori culture, the head is very sacred. So and these were things that we were taught before we even started to practice. So it's a really important thing that you know those things before you practice, because it can change things dramatically to your trust as soon as you meet the patient. And it's something we do automatically in our culture, isn't it? Yeah. Like, go and examine someone. So really
same
important.
For social care, you know, because you can go into people's houses and then you can come across as disrespectful. So sometimes, like, wearing your shoes into someone's house is considered to be disrespectful. Mm. And that automatically changes, doesn't it, your relationship with that person.
Yeah, which moves us on to cultural competence. It's important to remember that cultural competence is not just in relation to ethnicity, but also can be sexuality, disability or socioeconomic status. So Weaver, in a paper in 1999, which we'll put a link to, identified some factors as being quite important in developing cultural competence, and that is critically reflecting upon and identifying one's own beliefs and biases. So things like recognising the impact of colonial histories, increasing knowledge and awareness of differing cultural groups, understanding and valuing the notion of diversity, recognising the level of historical or contemporary distrust between various groups, and appreciating the significance of difference in helping relationships and including the impact of power dynamics within those relationships as well. And then there was another paper in 2009, YU, who found two false assumptions which are implicit in cultural competence. And those were that the way in which people interact with health and social care is inevitably shaped by their culture, which does not allow for an individual view of the impact of their culture, and that all members of a group conform to the same cultural practices with the same intensity.
So both of those things are false.
False indeed,
yes.
Yeah.
So people in the same group don't all necessarily practice to the same intensity, and the way in which people interact with health and social care within a group is relatively individual.
In addition, Wills in 2017 identified how prioritising cultural identity can have the potential to ignore or minimise the importance of other aspects of an older person's identity, such as their sexuality or gender, And this reductionist view having the potential to attribute the reason for a person's behaviour to a culture alone rather than any other reason. So it's kind of oversimplifying something, saying, well, this is because of this, and actually ignoring a whole other aspect of someone's personality. So it's something to be really mindful of.
And then I think people have taken that on, and in a... Funny you mentioned New Zealand, actually. In the New Zealand Social Work Journal a couple of years ago, there was an article that looked at what was important when understanding a particular cultural background. And actually, there were a few things that were more important than actually understanding the cultural background. And they were having a respect, having empathy, having a genuine interest in that person, giving them time and being patient, especially when the communication was difficult and time-consuming, being an active listener, showing tolerance and acceptance of difference, and combining compassion with care and honesty. All of which are kind of is person-centred care, isn't it? We've talked about quite a lot, and if there is a theme through all of these podcasts that we've done, it is person-centred care is the thing that sort of... We've dropped the breadcrumbs all the way through it, isn't it, I think?
They're just acknowledging that actually you don't need to know everything about a different culture, yeah. But you have that ability to want to identify that there are differences and that might affect your patient.
And I think it also takes some of the anxiety about the feeling that you don't know everything about all cultures. Actually, if you show respect and you know, be patient-centred, then that will get you a long way.
People are often really happy to tell you about their culture, aren't they? And explain it to you if you don't understand.
And often eager to,
to
share
really
that knowledge.
Keen to do that.
So quite interestingly, there's a paper in 1994 by Proctor and Davies who talked about practitioners' fear that if they admit that they don't have cultural knowledge makes them look professionally incompetent.
It's just, I think it's about if you think you lack that, it stops you asking those questions, I suppose, because you don't want to look ignorant, do you? And I think your concern is that you look like that ignorance, that you don't understand this person's culture, and therefore you won't ask any direct questions about it. Because I think sometimes also people fear that they can be discriminating against somebody, when actually, as we were saying, people are really often quite keen to tell you about their culture and for you to explore it that way.
So this having this kind of colourblind approach is not necessarily that helpful. In order to try and treat everyone equally, you're actually then ignoring really important things about that individual.
So there's relatively little research that considers the older person from different cultural backgrounds and the impact of ageing of that person within a predominantly white British culture. Way back in 1928, Robert Parks discussed the concept of the marginal man, in inverted commas, a person who lives in two separate cultures, so they're not fully integrated into either. That has the potential to have significant impact on someone's identity and sort of have personal consequences from that. So that might be somebody who lived in one country for a period of their life and then has moved, say, to the UK, and so still has ties to their pre-existing culture, if you like, but it was also integrating within the culture of where they now live, and they sort of sometimes fall betwixt and between.
And I think an example of that we see quite often practically is in caregiving and the role of family versus formal carers from different cultural backgrounds in the UK.
And Uncle, they did a piece of research and they said the state that it's a traditionally held belief that Asian societies, they're much more respectful towards their elders than people who live in a Western society. And they say that's due to this strong link to Confucianism, which sees the family as filial piety. So that's respect, demonstrating respect for your sort of father, your elders, for your ancestors as well. And that's a fundamental part of their beliefs. So Hung Hai in 2003 suggests that there are two forms of filial piety. So there's a reciprocal example which sees care being provided due to the fact that we love someone and we respect someone and therefore that we want to care for them, and it's like we're paying back or we're repaying our parents for the care that they have given us as we were growing up, and because of that we'll make sacrifices because we want to repay them for the sort of love and support they've given us. But there's also an authoritarian sort of version of filial piety, which encourages obedience and compliance, And that could be considered a mean of social control. So that sort of idea, well, you will do this. Mm. You're not doing it out of love. You're doing it because you sort of feel that you have to, a sort of duty to do that. But more commonly, filial piety is defined as a set of attitudes and behaviours which demonstrate love, respect and care towards our parents, which can lead to elderly parents having strong expectations of their children.
There's a couple of articles that go into that in a bit more detail that we'll put references in the show notes from the Gerontologist and also the Journal of Ageing Studies. We'll pop them in there.
So Laidlaw et al. In 2010 did some research comparing three different cultural groups. Two were based in the UK and comprised of a sample of older adult Chinese immigrants and UK-born older adults. The third group were older Chinese adults living in Beijing, and they wanted to look at whether older people in Eastern and Western societies have similar expectations for filial support and whether the ageing process has influenced that expectation. And they found that the two Chinese groups had similar attitudes to filial piety. The Chinese immigrants and UK participants had similar attitudes to ageing, and the Chinese older people living in China had a more negative experience of ageing. They found that the concept of filial piety remained strong in immigrants despite becoming part of a new culture over time, and that psychosocial loss contributes to an expectation of filial piety, which is linked to negative expectation or experience of ageing. So a loss or feeling decrepit, which engenders a feeling of helplessness. This compares to Western societies who tend not to have a philosophy of care, which encourage sacrifice and care for the older generation. Instead, older adults are quite often viewed as a burden or a drain on resources, and that's from a report in the World Health Organization 2002.
This makes me think of an episode of This American Life, which is my probably favourite podcast other than this one, of course. And I can't guarantee that I will be able to find the link to the exact episode, but it was talking about culture and cultural perceptions of health. And there was a story in the podcast about an older Chinese lady who had lung cancer. And the story was about, do you tell the person that they've got this nasty illness, or do you talk to the family? And there was a cultural difference between the Chinese-American part of the family and the part of the family living in China as to which way around this was done. And the question posed by the story was, does that affect your outcomes? You know, if you know that you've got a terminal illness, do you revert to that?
You know, I've experienced that in practice. I think when I worked in Frimley, there's a big Nepalese population, and again, it was a big discussion about often, do you talk to the family or do you talk to the patient, because that was their tradition. And there's a lot of this sort of research by the palliative care team there to think about what we should do, because just because they were living in the UK, did that mean that we needed to force our beliefs about what we should do? So it was really interesting about the differences that we might go into depending on the culture of the patient.
Yeah, so that links nicely into thinking about how culture influences the healthcare of older people. And most healthcare services stem from what already exists. So as most migration from minority ethnic groups happened in the 1960s, there have been fewer older people from those communities. Hence, healthcare issues that arise as we get older tend to match much of the English Caucasian community, but they don't necessarily match the needs and meet the needs of other communities who are now ageing and getting to a period of sort of advanced age in the end of their life. However, nationally, this has been recognised, and there is a drive to try and develop services to match the needs of people from a range of cultural backgrounds. And that's especially important now as the population from these older population from this range of different groups is growing rapidly. Older people from all backgrounds may not seek the medical support that they require. So Gagan, who makes this episode with us, works particularly set up a charity looking at trying to deliver outreach care to Sikh people living in the UK, because often he's found that they do not access health services as much, and is doing amazing work at sort of an outreach and engaging with other people.
Well, actually, it's a British Sikh Doctors Society, but actually they don't limit themselves to
Sikh communities.
Yeah. That might be for many reasons. So the older generation tend to be more stoic, especially those who have lived through years of hardship. And they tend to have great respect for healthcare staff quite often, and advice is often received well and taken on board.
But if English isn't your first language, it can be much harder to take on that advice. And conversations about fertility, sexuality, contraception, and other more taboo subjects, if you like, can be particularly tricky, particularly if that's influenced by that person's cultural beliefs.
So we're going to talk about some things that are commonly affected by culture. So things like DNA CPR, end of life, incontinence and cognitive impairment. So we're going to start with DNA CPR and end of life care. So what are some of the potential challenges we might see in this area?
It may not be part of their culture, or it might be against their cultural belief to even discuss it or consider it in the first place. So it might not exist in countries that the patients have come from, and particularly in South Asian communities. Some cultures may believe in inverted commas treatment to the end. And then you have in other communities that palliative care and DNA CPR is seen as a withdrawal of treatment, and care is viewed as being unethical and unkind.
There's been a really nice series of tweets in this week that we're recording this by the BGS, I think must have come from an end-of-life conference, talking about end-of-life care and palliative care with people who follow the Jewish religion, and what is sort of culturally acceptable and what is not, and sort of laying that bit out, which I thought was really good.
And I think that's the bit that's really important, is what we consider being completely ethical and kind to feel completely different, especially as the movement to do much more palliative care and involve palliative care much earlier in the UK is being such a big push and I think being adopted quite well. We do need to bear in mind what that means to other people and whether that actually that is something that they are wanting to accept, or the way that it's framed for a predominantly white British culture may not appeal or be understood by other cultures as well, and being mindful that actually what you're trying to achieve is the same thing. So healthcare staff need to be aware of their patients' cultures and religions in order to be able to take on those situations and navigate them well. Being aware of that means that you'll be able to hold conversations with patients and their family around these issues much easier. In some cultures, there might be a community leader or religious figures or family elders or other key members who you might need to have at such meetings so that you can make decisions, and navigating that early can mean that you can plan for that and involve people.
I've used that with someone who I once looked after, who was Russian Orthodox, and involving their priest was really, really useful in discussing these sort of topics.
Also being mindful to use an interpreter when someone's first language is not English, and they might find that conversation easier, is really important. And not always relying on a family member, so that you can have that honest conversation with them.
I think it's also important with that, isn't it, that even if somebody's spoken English for quite a long time, I don't know, for example, like after a stroke or something, you can revert back to your first language.
Yeah.
I was once involved with somebody who spoke an African dialect, but it was a really remote dialect, and it was really difficult to find anybody who spoke the same language, but they'd spoken English for a long time, but the result of the stroke had changed their ability.
And quite often the medical language won't have a direct translation, or you know, family members might find that much harder, even if a family member is happy for a family member to translate for them. Some can get lost there, so having someone who is employed to do that can be really helpful in navigating those areas that family members might not know how to translate.
I think it's also important to be mindful, isn't it, that maybe their translation as well is something that they want to happen and not what the person wants to happen. And we don't necessarily know that.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful about that and think about whether it should be a paid interpreter.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And they're often difficult conversations as well, aren't they? So you're always going to be more comfortable having those in your most natural language. So it just might make that a little bit easier for them to negotiate.
One of the things you can use is you can use Language Line, which is a way of communicating. You kind of have to keep passing the phone between you, but it's one possibility. And I've also seen people use Google Translate that will talk out the language to people. Non-Language Line.
So there is, if anyone hasn't seen it already, there's a BBC 4, I think. Is it, or 3? comedy with Joe Brand, who used to be a psychiatry nurse, I think, called Getting On. It is so painful. It's like the driest thing. Have you guys seen it? Oh, Jesus. So it's really painful. But there's one episode with a lady who doesn't speak English and they just can't understand what's going on. And there are just some really shocking examples of things I'm sure we've all seen done to some extent and some that should never be. But you can see that it's not that far from what might happen. One, using your language line and trying to translate down the phone through someone who clearly doesn't speak that language. And also an incredible one where, which is a really good example of a post-take ward round that's completely useless, and diagnoses UTIs and confusion in people who you just haven't got a proper history from, which I use quite often in teaching, but purely just because this woman cannot speak English and that's basically the only thing that's wrong with her. She just happened to end up in hospital. We might put a link to that.
So then, moving on, thinking about continence and particularly incontinence.
So in some cultures, the idea of passing urine in stool can be perceived as a dirty act. So, for example, in some Indian communities living in India, toilets are not kept at home and people will go somewhere else to open their bowels and pass urine and communal toilets away from their own homes. Things like using one hand for cleaning oneself after going to the toilet, even though you wash it, is still recognised as more of the dirty hand, while the other hand is considered more clean and would be used to eat and drink with.
Being incontinent of urine or faeces, regardless of your background, is difficult for a person and it can affect their social life, their sex life, their home life, their interactions with other people. And people will often not seek help and advice to help them with their incontinence. And we've done a couple of episodes on urinary incontinence and also faecal incontinence. So for those specific areas, you can head on down to those episodes or just for a bit more information about those.
And in certain cultures, incontinence is kind of just accepted as part of ageing, and the loved ones of the person going through this support them in helping them to wash and clean. I mean, in those communities, sufferers may not seek support or help from healthcare or social services because it's just believed to be part of what normally happens. And I think actually we see that in a lot of cultures. Mm. Some research done a few years ago, about 10 years ago, identified some areas that can help to support women to seek help. So in particular, access to a female GP, and if possible, a GP with a similar ethnic background might help to open up some of those conversations, particularly around continence. And they might prefer to see an allied health professional, so a nurse or a physiotherapist. And in the research, they kind of, again, implied that they would prefer that to be someone that's female. So being mindful of that with sort of staffing issues, it's not always easy to do that or to have that everywhere, but just bearing in mind that might be a barrier to someone opening up, and that might come at a different stage. Mm. And part of what's really nice about working in a team is actually you might get that information for different members at different times.
I think it's allowing people to choose what they want. Yeah. There was a thing in the news this week about Meghan has just chosen her obstetrician and has chosen a female obstetrician because that's the person that, you know, she agrees with, and it was all over the news. Oh my God, this is a snub to the Queen because the Queen has a male gynecologist, and you know they should be using this. And it's like, come on, let people do what they want to do. This is the whole point of this about being person centred, is that, you know, if people want to do whatever they want to do, then let's try and facilitate that.
So if we think about dementia and cognitive impairments, some cultures still do not recognise dementia at all or cognitive impairment as a medical problem. So again, it's the same. It's sort of a process of getting older. And they believe that if you have cognitive impairment, you become unwell due to black magic or witchcraft or voodoo or ghosts or maybe spiritual beings. So it's recognising that, and some cultures believe that that's part of, as we said, normal ageing, and then won't seek help that could really benefit the patient. It's also in some cultures the cognitive impairment is not noticed, so the family elders are taken care of by their younger family members, so they may not see medical professionals, and therefore that's not recognised, so that and then they don't seek that support that they need. So these patients are diagnosed a bit later and only seek help when they get acutely unwell. So again, they're missing out on the care that they need.
I think also sometimes that's that the family members have been supporting in such a way that they don't necessarily have the opportunity to display those deficits anymore because they're being so well looked after. In that environment, I remember taking my nan Christmas shopping a few years ago, and I hadn't realised how bossy that she had. Well, I did know. I always knew she was bossy. But that she had become quite disabled from having her hips done and things like that. But actually, she would just sit at home and bark at people to, like, do this and that. And actually, I hadn't noticed that she could only walk about 10 metres at a time because that's all she needed to do, because we were just running around doing all that stuff for her. And it's that kind of compensation, isn't it?
I only realised my mother when she came to stay and then realised she didn't sleep. She slept for about 10 minutes and then she was wide awake and thought she slept forever. It was only until you have someone in the house, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you realise how disruptive things are, or how they've masked things as well, which I think is interesting.
So as healthcare professionals, what can we do to try and improve our knowledge about different cultures? So I think the first bit is about reaching out to your local communities and try and meet with them and learn about their healthcare needs, their concerns, their worries. I think we can use community leaders and staff. So from the same culture as the people you're trying to engage with, to try and reach out and reach into those communities.
We can work with local and national charities to hold health screening and educational events, and particularly within cultures where maybe they're not seeking that help. We can review the local services that are available and have a look at strategies to help the needs that you have and the cultural communities that you have within your area, and then make use of interpreters or things like we were saying before, Language Line, to help with the communication with these cultures.
Yeah, and I think not assuming that because somebody can speak English that that's the language that they wish to converse in. And sort of engaging people and asking, you know, how do they want to talk to you? And I think one thing is just be aware of what's going on. Have a think about what festivals and celebrations are happening at the point in time for the various communities that you're trying to support.
So things like inviting someone to come to a clinic during Ramadan may not be a good idea. No. Thinking about people's, and then if they don't come, not discharging them because they didn't come when you just weren't aware of that. Things like diabetic control during, again, fasting periods like Ramadan, other celebrations, that you can work with people to optimise their health during that time.
Or clinics on certain days of the week, for certain cultures and things. So that's everything we wanted to say. So there's loads more on this. So I'm sure there'll be a healthy debate in the Twitter club that happens over the next week. And the hashtag for that is #MDTClub. And go and contribute to that discussion that's curated by Dan Thomas up in Liverpool. The show notes for this episode will be on the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk. Or you can follow us on Twitter.
@MDT_podcast.
Or Facebook.
.com/MDT podcast.
And head on down to the website for the CPD log, all the other show notes, the infographic, all the episodes that are out there in the past. So go and delve in. Have a little bit of a mine if you've not... Yeah. Not been down there before.
The MDT podcast.
And now it is time for the MD teaser. This is our catchily titled MDT item guessing game. And Joe, you're going to go first this week, I have decided.
Excellent. I have brought a cracker. I'm always proud of them. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is niche. I'm not going to lie to you. So, this references a cartoon from the 80s, 90s, when I was growing up.
Is it Danger Mouse?
It is not. That was a favourite. I was very scared of Danger Mouse. Stop it. No. How is that a cartoon? How is that an MDT guessing item? Right, so...
He-Man.
You're disqualified. So, this is on a farm, and there are two people on the farm. And one of them is a Frenchman. Who's shouting, I'm here, on this farm. And he's shouting to this girl who is a cartoon character from the 80s, 90s. She's wearing what we would today consider to be a smartwatch. Very futuristic. She had blonde pigtails and she worked with an inspector. She's trying to find this Frenchman. The Frenchman is saying, I'm here, but in French. That's the clue.
The Frenchman's saying, ici, ici. Okay. But I don't know.
She's wearing a smartwatch.
She's got blonde hair and pigtails.
Is she working with Inspector Gadget?
She was.
That doesn't help.
This hinges on me having got her name right.
Okay, so you're asking for the female companion of Inspector Gadget.
Yes.
No idea. Oh,
no idea.
So I believe her name was Polly. They're on a farm, and the Frenchman's shouting, "Issy, Issy, Polypharmacy." Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, that's fairly tricky.
I didn't say it wasn't difficult.
Okay, all right.
I think niche was definitely the right word.
Yeah, okay.
So, sadly, Kev, our producer, has pointed out that it was Penny and not Polly who was the little girl in Inspector Gadget, which means my MDTs are falls apart, which is really frustrating because I was really, really proud of it. But I have to concede that this time round, it was a fail for me. I will do better next time.
So I've got one of two, so I think we'll go with this one then, given that you did that one. Right, so to imagine a scene, it's on a boat and there's a cruise ship. And there is a waiter bringing a tray of food to the table. And the boat is in a bit of a rough sea. So the waiter's walking down the corridor and the tray is moving around as he's trying to keep everything balanced. But all the food keeps sliding off the tray. So then he goes back to the kitchen and this time puts something on the tray. And this is the thing. And as he walks along, the tray keeps moving, but the plates don't slide off the tray anymore.
It's like mat stuff. What's that mat stuff called?
Non-slip mat.
Yes, that's it. Yes.
Ah. Yeah. I mean, it's not nearly left field enough.
And to finish up this week, we've got the gallery. And Aoife, you've brought something this time.
I have indeed. So this is a poem by Maya Angelou. And it's called On Aging. So when you see me sitting quietly, like a sack left on a shelf, don't think I need your chattering. I'm listening to myself. Hold, stop, don't pity me. Hold, stop your sympathy. Understanding if you got it, otherwise I'll do without it. When my bones are stiff and aching and my feet won't climb the stair, I will only ask one favour, don't bring me no rocking chair. When you see me walking, stumbling, don't study and get it wrong, because tired don't mean lazy, and every goodbye ain't gone. I'm the same person I was back then, a little less hair, a little less chin, a lot less lungs and much less wind, but ain't I lucky I can still breathe in.
The MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a hearing aid podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.